Today is Wednesday. It's September 20th, 2023, and it's 2:42 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share it with your friends, give us a good review, and don't miss Tuesday night. This coming Tuesday night, we're recording it live at Second City. We're going to be up on the stage in Chicago from 6 to 8 p.m. Get your tickets. We'd love to see you there. I think you'll really have fun. Just get your tickets at WGNradio.com/rascals. By the way, you can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, what's up, guys? Brandon Pope here, host of the now Emmy-nominated TV show On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago. And host of WBEZ's Making Podcast.
Congrats. I didn't hear that news. Nice drop there, man.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, this is Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, weekly Substack newsletter, former Tribune columnist. And if I had a vote for the Emmys, I would vote for Brandon Pope, but
oh,
I don't have
man.
A vote.
So, that's so nice.
So I will try to rig the election somehow.
At least vote twice.
We just need what? We just need 20,000 more. Just 20,000 more. Yeah. We'll make our calls.
The No Cash Bail Provision of Illinois Safety Act has passed judicial review. It's been deemed constitutional, and now it's law. So as of Monday of this week, you're either in or you're out of jail. Money won't help anymore. So how are the judges doing is the question in Chicago. Have you been watching the news to see what happens when someone drives drunk or assaults a girlfriend or pepper sprays police officers or throws a chicken sandwich at someone? I have been, and I've noticed that mostly people don't go to jail. And sometimes they give them electronic monitoring, but everybody then has a court date later on.
Well, look, we were told that there was going to be chaos on the streets and that criminals were going to run rampant. And hide your kids, hide your wives. I don't see any of that. It seemed like it went without a peep mostly. We saw a county actually not go forward and do what they're supposed to do by law with the Safety Act. And we saw a few snags in some smaller counties. But aside from that, everything I've heard, especially from DuPage, from Cook, it's been pretty smooth, and part of that's because they've been prepared. The DuPage County State Attorney Berlin, I had a talk with him where he was talking about the details and preparation they went through. They went through mock trials. They sat down with police officers and went through different scenarios with them. So they've been preparing pretty heavily for this, and it rolled out pretty smoothly for those that did prepare for it. It is a big change, but it's now the norm. It's about to be the norm here in the state.
Yeah, I don't see any problem developing yet. And, you know, obviously this is one of those situations where time will tell whether this has a negative impact on society or not. The idea behind this reform is that whether or not you have money should not influence whether you're held behind bars. Like if you commit a domestic battery, if you're a threat to your spouse or to the community or a flight risk, then you should be in jail awaiting trial. If not, it shouldn't matter how much money you have, whether you're walking free. And it's sort of, it's a new standard that they can't just say, well, we'll set a bail so high that you can't get out. That is essentially criminalizing poverty, which we just don't want to do. And again, if it doesn't work, if it looks like, well, the justice system just can't handle this, then we may have to go back and change it. But I see no reason why it shouldn't work. I've been reading the same stories you have, John, about, judges wrestling with this stuff and letting people go. And again, it's going to be, there's going to be anecdotes of people who are let out and commit crimes. That's for sure. That's happening already. People who bond out commit crimes. I think we just have to realize that there's some fundamental moral fairness to this that supersedes this idea that we can set bail high enough to keep people locked up who, if they had money, they wouldn't have to be locked up.
Yeah. I think underlying that is the notion that you're already guilty. You wouldn't be in this straight. You would not have been arrested if you hadn't done something wrong. That's almost always true, but the system still doesn't work that way. You still have to be found guilty before you're punished. So you should get out. Better to take care of your family, go to work, mount a defense. That all makes sense. But people are still frustrated. What should happen? when kids close off an intersection and jump up and down on cars. Should they be charged? Should they go to jail? What happens when somebody pepper sprays a police officer, as one woman was charged at the Mexican Day celebration, Independence Day celebration? But I think a lot of that is born of frustration and anger at what happened. But technically, those people are still not guilty of any crime.
John, but right, even the system right now, if a judge decides, or the judge and the prosecution decide that this woman who pepper sprayed a police officer, if they feel that she is a flight risk, if she is a danger to the community, if we let her out, then by all means, keep her locked up. And there are certainly crimes that for which people are going to be locked up before trial. They're not going to be let go. The idea that, well, if let's say we set a $10,000 bond or something like that on this woman. If she's got the money, she can walk free. But if she doesn't have the money, she can't. That's just wrong to me. I mean, as I see it. So I hope that the justice system rises to the challenge of figuring out who is a risk and who isn't a risk, because it is destabilizing to families and communities if people are locked up and they can't make money and they can't help their families and so on. So if they are found not guilty, and I know that doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. There are people who are wrongfully arrested and deserve their day in court.
I think a lot of these cases, too, like the DUIs, pretty much you go home. That woman is probably not a serial police pepper sprayer. Mostly these are one-off incidents in people's lives. So the fact that you release them pending a court date doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to do it again. And the evidence in other municipalities and states where laws like this are in place shows that mostly people don't commit crimes at a higher rate than they did before. And they, over 90% of the time, they show up for their appointed court dates. So you don't have to keep them locked up. But what this whole thing has done is shine a light on the kinds of crimes that are being committed and what does happen. When's the last time we had a conversation about, you know, the kind of nonsense that these judges have to deal with every day? And what should the system do with them? We do not have enough jail space for everybody that people want to put in jail.
Costs money. That's the thing. It's a issue that taxpayers should care about. Like this should ease things for taxpayers as well. But yeah, we got to get the kinks worked out. I haven't seen many kinks yet. And obviously, you know, people who are high risk, I have no doubt they're going to be dealt with. They work to make amendments, or they got to make sure now that they're also a flight risk too. And yeah, if you're a flight risk, you definitely are someone that is too dangerous to be out and about. So we'll have to see how it plays out case by case. But so far, I'd say if you were to give it a letter grade, it's been at least a B+, if not an A-.
Yeah, and I would say it's an incomplete, because the proof will be in the pudding. Are we going to see a spike in crime? Is now everybody going to go AWOL? Let's see if it's discernibly different. It's too soon to tell. But right now, it does seem to be working in that people aren't being unnecessarily detained. They're being released. That's what it tries to do. To the people that say, I want the streets to be safer, that's not what this is designed to do. It's to treat people more fairly who would otherwise be incarcerated.
I yield to no one in my desire for streets to be safe. I just feel like there are going to be instances where people are let out without bond who might have not been able to bail, to post cash bail, who will commit a crime, maybe a horrible crime, and it's going to be an argument that's going to be, you know, run up the flagpole, and everyone's going to jump up and down and shout about it. The test is going to be whether this has any measurable effect on crime rates, on public safety. The argument for it having a positive effect is that you have people back in the community, and it's helped stabilize communities a little bit more. The argument against that would be, well, you're letting people out who we think have done something pretty bad, and that those people who do bad things are kind of more likely than the rest of us to do more bad things. And if that happens, if that turns out to be the case, then the argument for cash bail comes back into play. I can imagine the General Assembly coming back and saying, you know what, this didn't work. We tried. But so far, as you point out, John, the experience in other places is that it's just not that dramatic an effect either way. There's a fundamental fairness underneath it that makes it a more supportable system.
Well, that's it. And so you wonder what the tolerance level will be. Like, say we do see an uptick in crime because of this, right? Somebody goes, hey, you know what? I got out. I committed a crime on Friday, and Monday I was back on the street corner, maybe there would be a slight uptick in crime. How much of an uptick would we tolerate, and weigh that against the justice that is done to the people who should not be incarcerated because they don't have cash? I keep coming back to that point. I don't think this thing was designed with the promise that the streets were going to be safer. It was designed with the promise that people who are being incarcerated, pending trial, should be able to live their lives and pay taxes and tend to their children and not be held just because they don't have cash. That's the problem it solves. That's the only thing it fixes. No, I don't remember them saying, and this will make Chicago safer. So if it's going to make Chicago a little less safe, how much less safe are we willing to let it be before we then cancel the justice that is being done to the people that are otherwise incarcerated?
John, it's called the Safety Act.
It's in the name.
It's in the name. It is, really. But do you think I missed something there? I mean, was that part of the pitch? I don't remember them saying, and the streets will be safer.
There are certainly people out there in the anti-prison movement and so on who don't seem to care that much about public safety, who have different ideas than maybe those of us on the panel about the value of public safety versus the value of letting people run free who have been accused of crimes or convicted of pretty bad crimes. But I think that for the most part, the people who engineered this are looking for an overall system of justice that is more fair, is more just, and that in the long run does create safer communities. Now, they could be wrong, and I'm totally open-minded to the fact that this could be a experiment that doesn't work. But my sense so far, from what I know from other places and just from what I've read about the law, is that it could end up being actually an improvement. We could end up seeing people who are held in jail, who need to be held in jail, who otherwise would have bonded out.
Right, that's a good point.
Who then don't commit, aren't walking free to commit some horrible crime. And you know, the CWB Chicago, that news website, the anonymously run news website that basically covers crime in Chicago, they post stories all the time of people who are bonded out, who've been released under the old system, who commit horrible crimes. And so that's going to happen. And maybe some of these people would have been held instead of let go because the judge says, you know what, I can't just let you go, and we don't have a bail system to try to ensure you're going to come back, so I'm going to hold you. Yeah. And that person would not be free to commit the crime. So that's possible too, I suppose.
I asked Kim Fox about that. I said, does that happen? Because it seems to me like the people who commit these terrible crimes probably don't have great financial means. They're thugs, and they don't have the money to bond out and then go on to commit other crimes. That's what we're trying to prevent here. She said, no, that does happen.
Yeah. And some of them, of course, have drug money. I also want to advise you against using the word thugs, just as a by the way.
That's, gang members.
Thugs is, just, you know, Brandon, can you back me up on this? Thugs is just not a cool word to use.
Brandon,
in 2023, it can have a connotation, some feel.
Is that racially charged?
It can be.
It's considered to be, yeah.
I think it's how you use the word. Like, if you're calling like a kid in sports a thug, it's like, well, wait a second.
No, that's not what I did just now, right?
But, you know, if you're talking about an actual criminal, yeah, they technically are what they would call thugs. You're not wrong.
Well, I'm just telling you that's a word that I would be careful of.
I did talk to Senator John Curran, who is the Republican leader in the Illinois Senate, and he spent 19 years in the state's attorney's office in Cook County. I mean, he knows well what this whole wheel is like, and in fact has been an advocate for the Safety Act and the no cash bail provision. But he does think that all felonies should meet a threshold of the judge has the discretion to keep you. He wants to amend it, and it's not going to happen this fall, but he thinks next spring we can amend the Safety Act one more time.
Well, first, John, all felonies would be eligible for detainment. It would still be the prosecutor meeting a burden right now. Because of the approach, you know, we're still missing things like luring a minor, child abduction. Those are felonies that someone cannot be detained under current Illinois law. Under the dangerousness standard, we talked before about burglary is one that you cannot be detained. possession of a stolen motor vehicle. Those types of crimes are still out there. If someone is shown to be dangerous, the prosecutor doesn't even have the opportunity to file a motion and show that that person poses a danger to the community at large or a particular individual. Based on where we're at right now in the Illinois law, I'm looking to broaden that. It would have put it all in front of a judge, the judge's full discretion in that regard.
Pardon me, John, but are you saying that in the instances you just described, luring a child into a car, burglary, possession of a stolen vehicle, the judge cannot order those persons detained?
Those first couple, John, under either standard, yes. Possession of stolen motor vehicle, if they're a flight risk, a judge can order someone detained. But not under the community dangerousness standard, he or she cannot. And that is, so those are those gaps. Now, these are Class 4 felonies, but those are still gaps.
He wants every felony, all of those, should automatically land in the judge's lap with the opportunity to keep that person until their trial.
That's one thing that Berlin was talking about. He'd like to still see changed over in DuPage. So maybe, I'm sure there still could be some more digging in the meat of what exactly can be detainable and what can't.
Maybe we have time just to start this. Should the city run a grocery store, given the food deserts that we have, or food desserts, as Todd Stroger used to call them? Whenever I see that phrase, I always think of Todd Stroger. He more than once called them food desserts. The food deserts that we have in the city. Maybe the city, this is the mayor's idea, maybe the city should operate grocery stores in Woodlawn or Austin or some of those neighborhoods. Stock it with good-looking peaches and fresh lean meats at good prices. I even say even run it at a loss. But I'm an outlier on this one, too. The Tribune's editorial was against it. My colleague Lisa Dent thinks it's silly. What do you guys think of the wisdom of the city or the prospects of the city running a grocery store?
I think it's an innovative idea. I think it's something more cities should think about doing. You get revenue, you take care of a pressing issue in the city, kind of kill two birds with one stone in a sense. I think outside the box in a sense. However, when I think a little deeper on it.
Yes. And you don't have to think very deep is what I'm hearing. There's some problems here.
It sounds better in theory than it may actually turn out in practice.
Well, you obviously don't run an Aldi store down the street. And now the city says, oh, by the way, we're going to run a grocery store. And
you're competing. Yeah, you're potentially hurting other businesses. Is the city run grocery store going to be specifically for areas of the city like Austin that are food deserts?
Yes.
There is no grocery store.
Well,
that would have to be, and there have to be some sort of like guarantee of mileage, of how far it's going to be. You know what I'm saying? So that you're not having that competition happening. Here's the other issue, though. How's a Walmart going to feel about this? How's a Whole Foods going to feel about this? How are your big box grocers who you still need to be in the city of Chicago and investing in the city of Chicago? How are they going to feel about having to compete now with an actual city-run, government entity-run grocery store? And then also, the elephant in the room, like many city-run things, are we sure the city can actually run a grocery store successfully? Like, do they even know how to do that? Some would say they don't know how to do a lot of things that they're supposed to be doing.
They couldn't run a parking meter franchise. Every price hike is going to be... Every price hike is going to be questioned. Every employee is probably going to want to be on some sort of city pension.
Sure.
You know, we're going to have all kinds. And anybody slips and falls in the vegetable aisle, the city's going to get sued. Every decision by this grocery store, everything, you know, you don't carry oat squares, you know, then the city gets all upset. And, I'll bet Monica Ang has some interesting things to say about this topic as well.
Yeah, I think she's chiming in now. We just heard her Zoom petition, so she'll probably pop up here.
But I see so many bureaucratic headaches. And you know what happens if a city-owned grocery store undercuts the prices at, say, an Aldi, Dominick's, or what? Not Dominick's. What's Dominick's?
Whole Foods.
Not Mariano's. Whatever. It's whatever. It's going to be Kroger. If they undercut the prices, then that's unfair competition. And if they sell for more, then everyone's going to have their be up screaming about how's the city charging more than Mariano's. I got to know what Monica thinks about this. We're going to throw her right into this and find out.
If they don't have economies of scale, how are they going to keep the prices low? Will the prices be subsidized? How could they match an Aldi, which is the most ubiquitous grocery store in Illinois? In fact, we have more than any other state, with Florida just being one behind us.
Of Aldi's? Is that what you're talking about, Monica?
Yeah. And it's a Batavia-based company, and I was getting my Aldi swag this morning.
Oh, wow. She's holding up her Aldi's bag, which is actually a very nice one. You were at some,
it looks nice.
Some
nice.
Sort of press event they were handing them out. How did you score an Aldi's?
The sale. So about every 6 months, they have a sale of Aldi merchandise, and the faithful line up, and we buy it. We're like the first ones to like buy.
Oh, wow.
The hats and the shoes and the fanny packs.
Let me introduce you and welcome you. Thanks for joining us. Axios reporter Monica Eng is here. She covers the food beat well. We asked her to talk to us a little bit about tipped wages for workers. But just now, and I'm glad that you've just joined us, we were talking about the city running a grocery store. And my pie in the sky idea was, we do have bona fide food deserts that the Aldis of the world don't seem to be able to resolve or, you know, sufficiently help. There's people who have trouble getting access to good food at good prices. And you see the evidence of that when you see the waistlines and the health scores of a lot of people in the city. The mayor has said maybe the city should run a grocery store. Look, government does deliver the mail most of the time. Bad example. But, I mean, there's a lot of things we ask the government to do regularly that they do. Maybe they could run a grocery store. And I would say run it at cost or even subsidize it. Monica, to your point, yeah, even if they had to operate it at a loss, wouldn't that be a sufficient benefit for the city in the long run? People need food. They're not getting food with the system we have now. What's so crazy about the idea of the city trying to move into that space?
Not like they weren't subsidizing before. If you'll remember, Whole Foods got all sorts of incentives. And strangely enough, right after those ran out, that's when they decided to leave. I think it'd be great. There are subsidized farmers markets where stuff in the Englewood neighborhood and elsewhere costs less than it does at a Green City Market. And I am all for getting healthy food to people. Maybe 10 years ago, Natalie Moore and I, we went to a whole bunch of Aldis on the South and West Side to see if they were also selling organic baby arugula and kale. And, you know, we thought maybe we'd find out that they're not, but they were. And they were in some of the lowest income areas of Chicago. Are they in all of them? No. Are they very close to where that Whole Foods in Englewood left? Absolutely. But could there be more? Absolutely, too.
Is there a problem? Are there food deserts? And do people not have sufficient access to good groceries? I mean, I guess that's the definition of a food desert, but presumably people can travel. It's inconvenient. What's the solution then?
Well, over the last 20 years, I've looked at a lot of solutions. Some people talk about co-ops, and I've written about so many co-ops, and I'm like, this next year they're going to open, and then they don't. I mean, the only ones that have opened on my watch have been the Beet. What's the one in Oak Park? The Sugar Beet, I believe. But they have such a difficult time getting off the ground and getting enough people to participate. I wish I knew the solution. I mean, one of the solutions has to be the hardest part of the equation, which is taking generations of people who have not been in a community where it's celebrated. Hey, everybody, look at all this beautiful dirty kale I've got. Let's chop it up and make some kale chips. Let's make some broccoli salad. Ooh, look at this organic salmon I've got. When you don't have people around you all praising that kind of thing and making it like cool, it's hard to re-inject the idea that going to the farmer's market, spending a lot of money for fresh vegetables, coming home and cooking it and spending a lot of time cooking it, and then having your kids say, yum, yum, mom, make me some more. It's hard to create that paradigm which encourages more cooking and more healthy eating. And when you have generations that have lost that, I've talked to a lot of African-Americans older in these communities. They're like, oh, you know, I see you're buying collard greens and chili beans. Let me give you my recipe. And they said that they don't see the younger people in their community having that same tradition of cooking all those things. And that is what needs, you need to create the demand and the infrastructure and the education and the enthusiasm about it if you're going to get people to buy it from the store, especially for lots of money sometimes. I mean, it's fresh vegetables are not that cheap. And it's so much cheaper to get a 99-cent meal or a $1.99 meal. And guess what? Your kids will say, yum, yum, mom. They won't say, this tastes crappy, which as a mom, you know, you sometimes hear that. So after you do all that work, they say, I would rather have Flamin' Hots. I mean, how is that a reward to the mom?
That is interesting. That is very interesting. It reminds me of what what Michael Smith said. You know, we're losing recipes. That's literally what you're saying here. Like, that communal atmosphere when it comes to food.
But you got to make it cool and make it so accessible, affordable.
Yeah.
Have people feel like they have the time. Even in higher income communities, people are like, oh, I don't have time to cook. Well, where are your priorities? Are your priorities, and does our culture put a priority on spending hours cooking and saying that's okay, it's not a waste of your time? But so many of those intangibles are so much harder than a policy simply saying, we will open this. Yeah. Okay, you'll open it. How do you, like, you know, really get a groundswell of demand?
But you're making it sound almost ethnic, and I'm just thinking of it more nuts and bolts. I wonder if the people in these communities value or have access to a good bag of salad and some lean meats at a good price. I don't see that as so cultural as just convenient and affordable. And I'm wondering.
I certainly think it should be available in every community. I mean, strangely enough, my home in Lakeview, right around Belmont and Sheffield, was classified as a food desert until very recently.
Really? Because there's a Jewel just down the street from there, right?
Not that close. I mean, certainly not within a mile radius. And that's what the definition was. When they finally opened up a Whole Foods, then we were no longer classified as a food desert.
But that's not a poor neighborhood in that area.
No. And so it was like this strange thing. Like, I was looking at the heat map of food deserts and like, what? My neighborhood? And I'm like, okay, I see technically with their parameters. That's what it is. But that said, when I go to the South and West Side and I say, oh my gosh, you know, how is it that the people have to use a gas station or a corner liquor store as their main food source that's simply not giving them access to the kinds of foods that nutritionists would say they're eating? I mean,
and that's what I'm talking about here. So Whole Foods and Jewel and maybe Aldi isn't within a mile or isn't close enough. I don't know what I'm talking about here per se, but I like the idea of the city, like a fire department on every corner. I don't know. Let's have the city fund some healthier food stores, and I don't care. I don't know that the fire department makes a lot of money for us either, but we've deemed that it's a good thing for the community to have. Is there something like that that is conceivable?
Maybe we use that infrastructure of fire departments. There was a big push about a decade ago from Iman, which was a coalition of corner store owners, largely Muslim, largely Arab or Pakistani. And they said, we are going to get together because the infrastructure is there. The infrastructure of these corner stores is already there on the South and West Side, and said, we, because of our Muslim beliefs, we believe that we should be sharing things that are healthy for people. And they committed to stock fresh fruits and vegetables. I'd like to catch up and see how that moved. Panned out? You know, were they selling enough of them? Did it change the health of that community?
Monica, we asked you to join us today to talk a little bit about the tipped wage workers in Chicago. Chicago is on the precipice of being the largest city in America to abolish a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. What do they get now if you're a tipped worker? Is it like $9.48? The plan would be that over the course of 5 years, at 8% a year, they would get up to $15.80 would be the minimum wage that, say, restaurant workers would make. Of note, you wrote, workers could still accept additional tips, so the employers would have to pay them almost $16 an hour within 5 years. They could still make tips, although I think that's part of the conversation now. What happens to that, and do they come out ahead or not? You also wondered if this will discourage, say, restaurants from opening up in Chicago when they could just as easily put their money in Texas, where you say the minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13. That's so 1970s of them. So $2.13 in Texas versus what in 5 years will be almost $16 an hour in Chicago for every waiter and waitress and bartender. Wow. Is that going to pass the city council?
It looks like they have all the votes. I mean, it just came out of committee today, flew right through committee, and it looks like it has the votes in the full city council. As I said, if this and Bring Chicago Home pass within the first year of the mayor's tenure, it will, remake Chicago's code. It will scooch it to the left in a way I don't think we've seen that has ever gone so quickly. I don't see why it would not pass because the votes are there. It's going to be complicated. It's going to be confusing. If we can go by Washington, D.C., people are not going to understand what to do. Tips are going to go down initially. They may level off as they have done in D.C. What I heard from restaurant group owners who did not want to go on the record, but wanted to be on background as we approach this, was this is a one-size-fits-all policy in a very non-one-size-fits-all sector. I mean, you have nail technicians, barbacks, bussers, and then you have, Gene and George Eddie's and Gibson's servers who probably make $200,000 a year, much of it untaxed. Having a blanket rule for all of them doesn't always make sense. But I did tell this person, I said, there's no reason you can't pay your high-end server more. This is just the minimum. So if you're going to say that your server who's paying a mortgage and putting kids through school with their serving can't afford it anymore, why don't you pay them more?
Yeah, if I'm working at Gene and Giorgetti and I'm making six figures, I do not like this. I'm not going to make that kind of money at $16 an hour in 5 years.
Monica, I've noticed on social media some response to this, people saying, well, great, and we don't have to tip anymore. Or I'm not going to tip nearly as much anymore. Have you seen that in the response to what you've written?
And people are going to be confused, especially in the incremental period. So if they're getting an 8% raise, should I be cutting my tip by 8%? And then next year, I mean, the math is mind-boggling for an English major like me. So I think there will be definitely some confusion. And when I talked to Sam Toya, who's the president of the Illinois Restaurant Association, he says eventually we may end up being like Europe. I don't want to sound elitist, but I was in Europe recently, visiting my son, but you've probably been as well recently. And you're sort of like, okay, they don't expect a tip, but I really liked them, so I'm going to leave something. And my European friends are going to be like, oh, you're leaving too much. You're such an American. It'll probably end up being like that.
Yeah. And whenever I leave €2, I think, boy, that's cheap. But it's supposed to be zero. And then I feel guilty if I leave zero. I feel guilty if I leave two because that's so little. It's like, what? And it was only worth two extra euro. So well, I'll leave 10%. And I thought, what are you doing? I'm working against my own best interest here.
I always felt weird just leaving coins for the server. Yeah. But that's €2 of coins. If we can go by California and D.C., people probably will tip less and but it may even out. The other thing is what DC did. Restaurateurs, I don't get this. They said they cannot raise food prices. That people's eyes will pop out if the fried rice goes from $20 to $25. And so they think somehow, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong and they're right, that it's better to flop on a 20% service fee on the bill that people see at the end of the meal, when they're not deciding what to order.
So the owner of the restaurant says, it's not me that's making the money, just so you know.
Right. And so, well, when it says service fee, the restaurant can do anything they want with it. In DC right now, they're saying, if you say service fee, if you say this is for the server, you are going to be legally required to give it to the server. Right now, the law does not require them to give it to the server. And the other thing restaurant owners were saying to me is, I'm like, well, why don't you just do the service fee? That's what other people are doing. He's like, I'm not going to say it was. I will have to pay FICA on that. I will have to pay taxes on that. The server will have to pay taxes on it. I'm like, okay, you don't like paying taxes? Don't live in a society. But I think that's largely what it is. Servers at high-end restaurants, maybe not as much as in the past because everybody's using credit cards now, they have enjoyed a lot of tax-free income. Maybe they should. I mean, servers work hard too, but that's part of the unspoken resistance to this.
It's sort of talk about tipping without sounding like Mr. Pink, that character who's like, I don't believe in tipping. but you know, it's like, I don't know, like when I go to Starbucks, is the barista paid a minimum wage or a tipped wage? Because they've always got the, you know, they turn around the little machine and you've got the tip option on your on the screen. I certainly would, you know, definitely want to be fair to people who make, who count on tips for their living. Is the fact that someone who is making $16 an hour also counting on tips? How does that figure in? I mean, this is one of these things where I think, Monica, you say that the experience in Washington, D.C. has been that tips go down at first and then they just come back up naturally as people don't notice it?
Because people are still confused. Is there, you know, Washington, D.C. had a different implementation plan. In Chicago, it's 8%, 8%, 8% over 5 years, the proposal. In D.C., it was they jumped within 4 months to 50%. People were like, oh, and, you know, 50%, and I'm seeing these service charges. No way. And then people just kind of fell back on what Americans have done for the last 160 years, which is tip. And so I think they're just all, it's all going to be weird calculations in people's minds.
But what problem is this fixing? Why are they doing this anyway? What was the reason for this?
According to advocates, tipping is a racist and antiquated system that, you know, that disadvantages women, for instance. You know, if the guy's slapping your ass, your butt, and he says, hey, cutie, are you going to tell him, get your hands off me? Or are you going to smile and say, okay, I'm waiting for the tip? That was one of them. And that it was originally, you know, for people of color, for former slaves. Like, okay, you can work for a tip. And so they believe it makes it more predictable. Rick Bayless stopped tipping, or he put a service charge on and you can still tip earlier this year during the pandemic, because he said that his servers, you know, in February, if they wanted to, let's say, get a car loan and had to say how much they make each month, well, in February, it's really low. And so they couldn't put a consistent salary in there. And he says this gives someone a consistent salary where they know how much that they're going to be able to pay rent this month. And it's not going to be dependent on whether people came into the restaurant or not. So that said, the restaurant's going to suffer if nobody comes into the restaurant, but the workers will not.
But the idea is it's going to cost more to eat out because you're going to have to, the restaurant's going to have to pass those fees along. And there are already a lot of places you go now charge that 3 or 4%. I forget what they call it now, a COVID fee or health insurance fee or something that they add on. And you're ostensibly allowed to opt out of that. I don't know anyone who ever has. You feel,
you know, who wants to be that guy at the restaurant?
Yeah.
But it might not be more expensive to eat out, because if you're already a 20% tipper and the restaurant is either adding that to your menu prices or just putting that service fee in there, and maybe it breaks even.
And you discipline yourself not to tip on top of the 20%, right, which is a weird way to think about it. Discipline yourself.
Tipping is it is antiquated. The only reason why we really do it is because we have a system and economy that is depending on all of us to make up for people's wages they should be earning. It's a pretty messed up idea itself. We've just been doing it so long that it's second nature. And yeah, when you take a European trip or somewhere, you start to realize that they look at you like you're crazy. They think it's flabbergasting that we would do something like tipping. So I'm curious to see what other cities may start adopting a model like this. That gradual incline, I think, is very interesting. I'm curious, Monica. So Sam Toy, I know they've been negotiating. What sense do you get that he's feeling about this? I would assume they didn't want this to happen, right? But is at least a gradual increase better than what it could have been?
Absolutely. And I'll give you guys a little inside scoop. As I talked to against, you know, insiders who did not want to be named, they basically thought that Lori, who she pissed off everybody except for the hospitality community, she was good to not. They basically intimated that they were promised, when this person said, when I took out all these loans for my new places, I was promised that this one fair wage thing was not going to happen. And so now I've got to do all sorts of calculations. And so Toya was just like, look, yeah, I'll represent you guys. Don't worry. I'm not going to let this happen. But then he saw the writing on the wall. Johnson had the votes to make this happen. And so he was not coming from a position of strength. They did their 11th hour. Hey, how about if restaurants that earn more than $3 million a year give people a minimum wage of $20 per hour? That's what they were floating last week. And they just got slapped down. And so Toya goes back to his people. He's like, we got to get whatever we can get because this train is leaving. So he negotiated a 5-year deal versus a 2-year deal. So he could go back to his people and say, okay, this is going to happen. But hey, I got this 5-year deal, which is helpful. But he still believes it's going to hurt mom and pop restaurants. I believe, and he does believe that, you know, as I mentioned in the story, some big restaurant groups, when they're thinking about opening a new place, it's going to be Texas.
But if they go from where they are now to in 5 years, $15.80, that's about a $6.50 an hour raise. Say you work a 6-hour shift, that's $35-40 that you're going to get extra guaranteed. But I would imagine if you're a good bartender or waitress at even a moderately priced place, you're going to make $35 or more in tips anyway. How many of us have been just at a moderately priced restaurant and you leave 10 and you go, they left 10 and they left 10 and that's just this seating? I mean, I've seen the money pile up. I thought what would be a fair amount of money for a waitress or waiter, even if they're only making $10 an hour. I wonder how the people clearing the tables feel about this. Are they championing this, or are they looking like, be careful what you ask for?
First thing, until high-end servers are not in favor of this. One of them wrote an op-ed for the Sun-Times yesterday saying, you know, Brandon Johnson, you just ruined my life. And that was a Gene and Giorgetti server.
Wow.
But I mean, that said, I think Gene and Giorgetti's can find a way to either add a service fee, or if we go the way of DC, where the attorney general wants that service fee to be directed right at the server, then maybe they will still make that, and that and more. You know, the complicating thing, because this thing does have a lot of moving parts, is what about the people who tip out the busser, who tip out the runner, who tip out the bar backs, who tip out the bartender? You know, with these higher end places, there are a lot of people who get tipped out.
Does this apply to people that do your nails and cut your hair? Because they get tipped a lot, and I don't know, a lot of them.
Yes.
Really? So the people that cut my hair now, if they're working for a company that's, they get paid a sub-minimum wage because they're considered tipped workers?
Yep. Yep. Anybody who's considered a tip worker, including nail technicians and people who work at hair salons or people who sweep up at hair salons.
Boy, my wife tells me what it costs to get her hair cut, though, and that's a lot. And the tip on top of that is a lot. I don't know how this is going to affect everybody, how it's going to filter through. I guess there'll be winners and losers, huh, Monica?
Yeah. I mean, I always hate, and editors always hate, that time will tell. But, you know, it is such a new thing. Time will tell. Hawaii has tried some different versions of this, not exactly the same, so it's hard to use them as a model. But California, I think, will tell us sooner than later, and D.C.
Right now I'm thinking, what's 90? Normally tips say 20-25%, say 22%. So what's 92% of 22% of the tip I would leave? Because that would account for the 8% that they just now got as a raise each incremental year over 5 years. Is anybody following what I'm saying here?
No, you threw too many numbers at me. I'm a journalist, bro.
Math teachers and calculator makers are going to
do. I know. All right, Monica, really interesting, as always, really informative. Thanks for, you should do this more often, Monica. We really appreciate your help today.
Happy to do it. Take care.
Thanks, Monica. See you.
Monica, I'll see you tonight.
Tonight at...
You guys are partying somewhere. We're not invited. That's fine. I'm busy.
I got invited to dinner. It's an exclusive thing. No,
wow.
I'm
just saying. Are you going to tip? Monica, I want to
text me and let me know what this is all about. All right. Take care.
You don't know?
She doesn't remember. Like, what?
Will I be looking at my Gmail or what?
I think so. Yeah. I was told, hey, we're having dinner with Monica tonight. So.
Wow. Oh my gosh. How did I not remember this? Yes. Oh, of course. Thank you for reminding me. I forgot the way to do it. All right,
well, there
take
you
care.
Go.
Bye.
I'll see you soon.
See y'all.
I was talking to somebody on the air the other day, and they said, hey, and we'll see you at the banquet next week. You're the MC. And I went, oh, crap. I forgot. I do that all the time.
I get it. I do the same thing. It happens. It'll be in the calendar, but that doesn't really mean anything. That was good stuff.
That was really good. I think that's a podcast right there, John. I think we got...
I just think that a lot of the workers are going to come out negative.
I could see it. Especially the high-end one is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of what's a place where you would go and tip? Like a local pub on the corner where you get a burger and a beer. A burger and, a couple of beers and some fries. Your little basket there with one beer, what are you looking at? $20, right? And if there's four of you, that's $80 at that table. And 20% of $80 is $16. That's $16 for that table and a tip. It just seems to me like that's not an extraordinary check. That's common. It just seems to me like the math for most people, they're going to come out behind rather than ahead on something.
Well, especially if people decide not to tip. Now, the thing about that is when you're tipping $16 on an $80 check, that's not all going to your server. I mean, generally those tips are shared with people in the house, depending on who's, you know, the kitchen staff, the busboys or bus, whatever the proper term is, that those tips get shared. And so if you're thinking, one of the things that I always think when I'm dining out is that these people are really relying on me to make up the difference between what they're paid and even the minimum wage. The law says that the restaurant owner is supposed to do that. That if you don't get enough tips to come out to the minimum wage, the restaurant owner is supposed to make that up to you. Apparently, they don't do that often enough, and that's one of the reasons that they felt that this law was necessary. But as a diner, as a customer, I feel like this person is kind of counting on this tip. This is not just an extra thing. This is really part of their wages.
Especially if it's a cash tip.
So I would never, stiff someone at a restaurant. That would be terrible. On the other hand, if they're getting minimum wage, if they're being paid, then the tipping question becomes a little different. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
This is such a Chicago solution. I mean, we're so progressive. I just hadn't heard the hue and cry from people going, oh, this tipping situation is terrible, or I'm a sub-minimum wage worker. Are the nail techs and the hair people and all those people that were tipped? It seems to me like a lot of them are getting cash tips, and they're not reporting it, and they're coming out ahead more than to the tune of $6 an hour. My gut right now is like, thanks for nothing, Progressive City. This is not going to help me.
I feel like the idea is another one of those where, like, in theory, it sounds great. In practice, there's a lot to work out, right? Because in theory, my thought would be what the system should be is, we pay all usually tipped workers, we pay them the standard minimum wage. It should just be a thing already. And then the tipping system can be what a tipping system should be. Not a, you depend on this to live, but a, hey, I'm tipping you for good service. Great job. Here you go. I hope that the tipping doesn't completely go away. You know what I mean? I hope that culture still exists. And people don't just thumb their nose like, oh, it's more money anyway. That's the hope. And I think if that is what happens, then I think it could work out. But if we just eliminate tips altogether, then John, you may be right. There's going to be some people on the back end, especially like at those higher end restaurants. I can see why they'd be upset.
Man, 200,000. She said 200,000 some of those guys make. I believe it. We went to Gibson's Italia for a special occasion earlier this year. It was a very big bill. And the guy that served us was an artist. He had real skills. Like, this is a true profession. He was a professional, and we paid him a lot of money for our table. And there was tables everywhere, and everybody was doing that. And a lot of them were businesses, and I could see how that guy made six figures. And he doesn't want a $6 an hour raise. He wants 20% of $600, which is what this expensive thing costs.
I mean, there are some big spenders at these restaurants. I mean, John Williams in the house. I mean, come on.
It was a rare occasion. It was a rare occasion. All right. Eric said we are done, and Eric wants to save all the other good stuff we want to talk about for Tuesday night when we record our podcast at Second City. Brandon will be there. Your friend John Hansen will be there. The always insightful Austin Berg will be there. I'm not sure what we're going to wear. I think I've kind of kidded you guys about it, but I think Austin and Brandon and John and Eric should wear what they're wearing right now, whatever you're comfortable with. I want to see the real Brandon Pope. And we'll go for about 70 minutes maybe up on stage, and then we can take some questions from the audience.
It sounds like fun. Yeah, people are just going to be looking at Brandon's beard. I don't think the rest of us are.
I have been.
I'll make sure it's nice and oiled and moisturized.
So do you shave your upper lip then? Is that what you do? Or is there something going on there too?
So I try to, but I usually go to a barber because I got shaky hands. So I'm scared that if I do too much, then I'll just take it off.
Yeah, but the top of your lip is just this real thin wisp. And then you've got a whole Santa Claus thing downstairs. So that's the look you're going for, right?
That's the goal. That's the goal. I did this really for – I'm going to Mexico this weekend for a wedding, but it'll still be like this when I see you guys on Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. You land and then you got to come do our thing, right? If your flight's delayed –
I
got
to come on and do this. Yeah, we're ready to go.
All right. Well, I wish you safe travels. And thanks, guys. Brandon Pope and Eric Zorn were produced – this week by Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
All right. See you guys Tuesday.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
See you Tuesday.
Yeah, I'll buy the beers, boys.
Thanks, I'll see you.
See you later, boys.
Thanks.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.